just talking about Emily Dickinson's nature poetry and her poetry concerning the deity, as she perceived the deity. Before we come to the poems about the deity, though, which is on the schedule for today, I'd like to share one poem with you to conclude the nature series, and then talk a little bit about how she works, how she worked, what her techniques were. And we have a couple of poems, three poems that relate to that. First, let me read for you, since it's not on your handout, the additional nature poem that I want to share with you. And you tell me, if you can, what you think this poem, what kind of creature this poem is describing. It's kind of a interesting poem to get the feel of. What kind of creature is this? A root of evanescence with a revolving wheel, a resonance of emerald, a rush of cochineal, and every blossom on the bush adjusts its tumbled head. The male from Tunis, probably, an easy morning's ride. Right, one more time?
Yeah, that's great.
Join us. Why don't you come on over by Annie? She's got a hand out there. A root of evanescence with a revolving wheel, a resonance of emerald, a rush of cochineal, and every blossom on the bush adjusts its tumbled head. The male from Tunis, probably, an easy morning ride. Any guesses of what this creature might be? Kind of tricky. This is one of her more accessible poems. We just read it. We've shared some of those, including some of them at Vespers the other night. This is one that's a little harder to get out. A guess as to what it might be?
I have a guess, but I think you've probably read it to me before. So I don't get it.
Okay, let's take a look at some of the words which might be a little tricky. Evanescence is a word that maybe we don't hear every day. That would be something that's vanishing away. The idea is that it is disappearing, evanescent. And cochineal, what is cochineal?
Cochineal is a dye, purple dye that comes from a sea mollusk, and you make purple dye out of some essence that goes in the paper.
Right, it's purplish. It's purplish red, really. Mm-hmm. Sometimes described as Castilian red. Okay, now when you think of a purplish Castilian red, does that maybe give us a clue? We're just trying to figure out what kind of creature this poem is, Betty, that I've been... It isn't in the handout, so... Annie, what do you think it is?
I think it's a hummingbird.
Yeah, it's a hummingbird.
It's the image of the thing going round. What is that?
Yeah.
What
does it do? With a revolving wheel.
Oh, yeah. That makes sense.
Okay.
Yeah.
Let me read it one more time now, knowing that it is a hummer, and see if you can see the images of the hummer. A root of evanescence with a revolving wheel, a resonance of emerald, a rush of cochineal, and every blossom on the bush adjusts its tumbled head. The male from Tunis, probably, an easy morning's ride. Okay. So she's dealing here with the sensation that we get from a hummingbird, which moves so fast that what we are aware of is that, oh, there he is. Oh, it's gone. What was it? Did I really see that? Did I really see it? It's a genre portrait. It's a portrait of something in motion. She handles motion, by the way, better than still life. We saw one of her still life poems yesterday about the sifting snow. Still life portrait. This one is what she gets more into less space. This is concision itself. This is about as tight as it can get. It's a realistic sketch, but it's a sketch of motion, and it's a sketch of effect. It's a sketch of what happens. I saw one just the other day up on the flower box right on our porch up on Chalet 5. And he was there among the flowers, and the flowers are also colorful. He was not terribly colorful. She was a female rufous hummer, and not as brilliant as the male, and not as brilliant as other hummingbirds, so he didn't get quite the same color. She would have been talking about the most common eastern hummingbird, which is a very brilliant hummingbird, but still the sense of, oop, there he is. Oh, there he is up at the other flower. Whoosh, he's gone. Where did he go? Meanwhile, the flowers are still moving. Uh-huh. Right? And he's gone. She's gone. So you get that sensation of motion. Indeed, it did seem, and every blossom on the bush adjusts its tumbled head. There were three or four or five flowers there, some larger, some of the larger ones and some of the small ones, all of which were still bobbing their heads, and he's gone. Or she's gone. And where did she go?
I don't know.
Where in the world did she go?
Tunis.
You don't know, do you? Okay, so it might be Tunis. Mm-hmm. Why Tunis, do you think? Yeah, so far away. It's kind of romantic. It's kind of mysterious. You don't know. Could be any place. It might be still here in Faholen Village, but by now, hey, just an easy morning's ride to Tunis at that speed. They seem to move so quickly that it could be in Tunis. It could be in Tunis. The bird is sound. We hear the sound, and you do hear that, and that's the wings. And that's the wings. They do have a little call.
They do?
Yeah, they do, a kind of a song. That you'll hear sometimes before you see them, if you're out bird watching, looking for them, and you can hear kind of zee, 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 zee. That's the way this call sounds in the song. But you also hear the wings, that the revolving wheel. It doesn't really revolve, but it sounds as though it revolves. It's sound, it's iridescent color. The cochineal, what are you going to say?
Well, it's interesting when she says the revolving wheel, because my image then was of a helicopter, which is what a hummingbird is like, but of course, you should never see a helicopter.
I think probably not.
Yeah.
Probably not.
That's right. It really revolves.
No.
They
can beat real fast, very fast, and they can, as we all know, hover without motion, without moving forward or back. They can hover right over a flower.
That's where
the idea. Yeah, because the wings are interestingly, at the hinge, they are very flexible. One critic said that there's an instantation translation through space. Suggested. Well, she did one other on Hummer. Let me just share this other one with you while I'm on Hummers. I'll just read this one for you. This one, I think, is not quite as good, but it's still pretty good. It's almost as though this one that I'm doing here is a draft of the one that she came up with. You gonna say?
I wouldn't have recognized the hummingbird because I've never seen the East Coast hummingbird.
The Ruby Throated, yeah. Yeah, it's more brilliant. It's more brilliant than ours out here.
The ones just down there are gray.
Yeah, there are some out here. The Calliope hummingbird's a pretty brilliant bird.
No, they're not brilliant.
Well, they got that throw that if you get them in just the right light, they're brilliant, see? And that's the same with the Ruby Throated. You can see the Ruby Throated in not the right light, and it looks kind of dingy. Then you see it in the right light, and that throat just goes whoosh, just like a jewel. Just like a jewel. This is less good, but it's fun too, about a hummer. And this is more accessible. If I'd read this to you, you probably would have got it. Within my garden rides a bird upon a single wheel, whose spokes a dizzy music make, as 'twere a traveling mill. He never stops, but slackens above the ripest rose, partakes without alighting, and praises as he goes, till every spice is tasted, and then his fairy gig reels in remoter atmospheres, and I rejoin my dog, and he and I perplex us, if positive 'twere we, or bore the garden in the brain this curiosity. But he, the best logician, refers my duller eye to just vibrating blossoms, an exquisite reply. It's more straightforward, it's more accessible, but it's less an enduring joy. You can read this, it's kind of fun, but boy, I'll tell you, that Root of Evanescence, we can keep reading it and keep seeing more. By the way, when her sister Lavinia found her poems, about 900 of them, after Emily Dickinson died, the edition of this poem, which she then sent to Mabel Todd, who published, was one of the two people who published the poem, and this was one of the four poems that Emily Dickinson sent to Thomas Higginson during her life, saying, have I a chance to be a real poet? Would you be interested in having these published? Although she didn't say anything like that directly. She obliquely suggested it. This was one of the four, and the four were very carefully selected. But the one that she sent, that she wrote, and which her sister then gave to Mabel Loomis Todd, read like this. The second line had several variants, and this is where we come to the way she worked. The first and second lines go as follows. A root of evanescence with a revolving wheel. Revolving wheel is nice, but here are alternate readings of that line. With a delusive wheel, with a dissembling wheel, with a dissolving wheel, with a renewing wheel. These were written at the bottom of the page as alternates. So that's a suggestion of how she tried to choose the right word. And now let's take a look at, let's take a look at the two last poems. Let's take a look at the very last poem on our handout. Annie, want to read that?
We play at pace.
No, the very bottom, the second one. Then we'll do the top one.
Shall I take thee, the poet said, to the proposed.
Okay. Would be.
Shall I take thee, the poet said, to the propounded word, be stationed with the candidates, till I have finer tried? The poet searched philology, and when about to ring for the suspended candidate, there came unsummoned in that portion of the vision the word applied to fill, not unto nomination, the cherubim. Not unto
nomination. The cherubim reveal. How do you see this relating to her choice of revolving in the second line of the previous poem? Would you like to hear it one more time? You've got it right in front of you, but sometimes it's helpful to hear it twice. Somebody else want to try it a second time?
Shall I take thee, the poet said, to the pronoun
propounded? Okay.
To the propounded word be stationed with the candidates till I have finer tried. The poet searched philology and went about to ring for the suspended candidate. There came unsummoned in. That portion of the vision, the word applied to fill. Not unto nomination, the cherubim reveal.
Okay, what do you think is happening here then?
Trying to choose the right word.
Trying to choose the right word. So how's she going about it, Betty? What's her process?
Takes the word, lines it up like a candidate.
Yeah, like a candidate.
First you're proposed, you're lined up.
I think she relies on her voice. Maybe she'll tell her that's
okay, but what has she done at the very first part of it?
Be stationed with the candidates. Would that be alternate words that she read?
Sure. Right on. The alternate words.
Taking this word and setting it aside for a while until I look at some others.
Setting it aside with the candidates. What would that be?
The other words, right.
So in other words, the words that she's setting aside are delusive, dissembling, dissolving, renewing, delusive wheel, dissembling wheel, dissolving wheel, renewing wheel. Which one is the right one, it seems to me, she's saying. Which one is the right one? She's got them lined up, see? So she comes up with, let's say, she comes up with renewing. Okay, shall I take thee, the poet said, to the word renewing, to the propounded word, the proposed word, the word that comes to her? Well, let me put you over here with the other candidates. Be stationed word, renewing, over here with the rest of the candidates, and we'll see which one we like best. Till I have finer tried, till I've worked at it. The poet searched philology. What's she doing there?
Going through the dictionary.
She's looking
for
the meanings.
Looking for the right words. She's looking at books on words and language to try to come up with just the right one. And when she was about to select, maybe renewing, then what happens?
Right.
Prompted by whom or what?
Unsummoned.
Yeah, came unsummoned. So this wasn't one that she found in the lexicon. This wasn't one she found in any of her books that she was working at, nature books or whatever kinds of books. What prompted it to come?
It's a vision of thought. God.
Well, not well, bad, she's not God. Bad. What else might we say?
She's a
pantheist, though, isn't she? Sort of. She was a kind of transcendentalist, a kind of pantheist. There was a flavor of that in her belief, quite right.
The cherubim.
So the cherubim stand for what we might otherwise call, and what we were talking about this morning in Annie's Shakespeare class, the muse. the muse. And if we didn't want to talk in these kind of mythological terms, what might we call it more the way we would talk? Would be another word that we'd use.
Inspiration.
Inspiration. Okay? Inspiration. So, she's got these words lined up that she's thinking about. Let's see, that one right, that one wrong. I like that one, but I like this one a little bit more. Like that one. She's about to choose renewing, and then all of a sudden, the muse, inspiration, says, "Hey, Emily, baby, revolving." And she says, "Of course." Now, my example would be better if we had a series of words, and I don't know that we did, about the snake, when we came up with "and zero at the bone," which we talked about yesterday. And zero at the bone for the feeling that one gets when one is before a snake. You get short of breath and you feel zero at the bone. I mean, that's such an inspired word that all the other candidates that you could line up, how do you feel when you see a snake and it jumps away from you and you've got bare feet? And you feel I can't move. I'm frozen. I'm numb. My legs are weak. You feel zero at the bone. So that's inspiration. You don't think about that by lining up a bunch of words. So how about that nod unto nomination that cherubim reveal?
Wasn't even nominated.
It's
She hadn't even thought of that one.
Some of her poems talk about the hard work. We talked about a poem the other day about the flower working hard to produce the blossom, the bloom. Bloom is result. The bloom in a flower is the result of a lot of darn hard work by that flower. Guys, let's give this flower credit. Hey, good for you, flower. Really groovy, you got yourself a blossom there. You had to fight, you had to get your share of the dew, you had to keep the worms away, you had to get some sun for this potential bloom that's gonna come out. Now you got it. And Annie suggested, and some other folks thought this might be right, that she's talking about not just the hard work that goes into the producing of a blossom, but the hard work that goes into producing of a poem. And that's something that never occurred to me, but it's right there, I think. Any artistic creation, perhaps she's talking about some metaphor. The blossom is the metaphor for the artwork that results. One of Betty's paintings doesn't just happen. She has to work hard at it. But I shouldn't wonder, Betty, that sometimes when you are painting something, you're not quite sure how to handle something, and you're working at it, you're fussing with it, you're thinking of alternative ways to handle it, and all of a sudden, of course, that's the inspiration.
But then,
are they intuitive? Yeah.
But then to recognize that it's right.
Yeah. Because they always say you'll know when it's just.
She knew. You see, she didn't have any doubt about it. And when that right word came in, not unto nomination the cherubim reveal. In other words, it isn't that hard work necessarily. Perhaps you have to be in the process of working hard to have the concentration that goes into the inspiration by the muse. But the point is, it's not one of these words that all of a sudden seems right to you. No, it's like that the proverbial light in the comic strip, you know, when one of the characters gets the right idea, the light goes on. That's what it... Oh, of course, why didn't I think of that? Revolving is the way we want to describe that wheel. Zero is the way we want to discuss that bone. Zero at the bone. There's nothing at the center of the bone. The bone is cold. She did one poem, I just can't resist it since we're talking about this process, where she left a whole bunch of alternatives. It's kind of fun to listen to this. The poem is not really one of her better poems. It's not one of her most successful poems, but it's a fun poem. It's about butterflies. It's a more accessible poem. But what I want to do is just read it for you. And then I want to just read you some of the things that she had as alternatives, right? So here's the point. She was never satisfied with this poem. She never had it in final form. But this is the version that her sister found, and then beside it, on a scratch paper, she found all the alternatives. So she never felt that she finished this, and we can understand why, because it's not a perfect poem, and she was always striving for perfection. She sensed its lack of perfection, but it has nice things happening. Two butterflies went out at noon and waltzed upon a farm. Then stepped straight through the firmament and rested on a beam, and then together bore away upon a shining sea, though never yet in any port their coming mentioned be. If spoken by the distant bird, if met in ether sea, by frigate or by merchantman, no notice was to me. So we have a couple of butterflies bouncing around, lovely, enchanting little butterflies, and then they land on a beam. Maybe it's a sunbeam. I don't know if it's a real beam or a sunbeam. And then they're gone. So then it's like the discussion of the hummingbird. Where did that hummingbird go, Eleanor? Went far away. But where? She's always curious. That's not good enough. Where did it go? She doesn't know. If they were ever seen again by a bird, the bird never brought back word. Never heard of where they went. So that's what the poem's about. And you might call it a brilliant failure, because it's got so many nice things going on. But it doesn't quite work. It doesn't for me, anyway. Anyway, here's the way she in the first stanza, she instead of saying, and rested on a beam, she wrote, and then espied circumference and caught a ride with him and took a bout with him. Circumference meaning for her way, 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 vast distances away. So she's in the very first stanza then sort of giving her or ending away. So she didn't like that, so she backed away from it. Stanza two, where she's got some alternatives to and then together bore away upon a shining sea. She's got, then lost themselves and found themselves, then staked themselves and lost themselves, then chased themselves and caught themselves in eddies of the sun, in fathoms in the sun, in rapids of the sun, in gambols with the sun, in gambols of the sun. Till rapture missed them, till rapture missed her footing. And then she's got gravitation chased, gravitation humbled, gravitation ejected, gravitation foundered, gravitation grumbled. Gravitation grumbled? Okay, we'll throw that one out.
Those are her notes. These
are her notes. It's the alternate ways she might read the lines. It was spaced in such a way that you could see that this was for the second stanza. And both were wrecked in noon. So she's got the story of the butterflies, what ultimately happened to them. And both were wrecked in noon. What a figure. And both were drowned in noon, and both were quenched in noon, and both were whelmed, as in overwhelmed, in noon, and they were hurled from noon. Fascinating. And then stanza three is an alternate way to read it. To all surviving butterflies, be this fatuity, be this biography, this biography, example and monition to entomology. So she didn't pick any of those. That's a suggestion of how she worked. Putting down, trying this, trying that, until all of a sudden, wacko, the inspiration. That's what it's got to be. And she would choose what she wanted. Let's take a look at the poem in the top of that last handout page, which is another poem about how she works. Somebody like to read that one for me? Betty, you want to try it? Just straightforward, read it. Nothing very...
I'm nobody.
I beg your pardon. We're on the very final page.
Sorry,
final page, top poem, just above the one we were just working with.
Okay.
Great.
We play at paste till qualified for pearl, then drop the pace and deem ourselves a fool. The shapes, though, were similar, and our new hands learned gem tactics, practicing sands.
Good poem for an artist to read.
Yeah, that's what I asked you.
Yes,
play at pace.
What is the message of it, Betty, would you say, or anybody? I want to put you on the spot.
Well, second verse gets into shapes. And after you've made a shape, you've learned something.
Mm-hmm.
And like talk about new hands. Your hands are new with a new experience. I have to jump back and play it.
How about, I don't want to have Betty be on the spot. Does anybody else have any ideas about what the poem says? What's the basic message of the poem? We play at paste till qualified for pearl, then drop the paste and think deem ourselves a fool. The shapes, though, were similar, and our new hands learn gem tactics practicing sands.
Is this a play on the, that you're trying to make out of paste the real pearl?
At what point in your development as an artist would that be the case, Betty?
Well, that would be in the beginning when you
beginning.
Can't make a pearl. Yeah.
Right on.
You can't make a pearl. So you
exactly,
make a paste,
right?
And you drop it because you
Well, when is it that you say you're a fool? The present tense of fool is a little deceptive there, and deem ourselves a fool. That's a little tricky. When does the artist deem herself to be a fool?
After a couple of failures. Or
yeah.
What we perceive
or after
to be.
You get into
it. Trying to do it.
You're almost on it. I just want you to... That's it, I think. See if you don't agree that that's it. We play at paste when we're just learning. Nobody's going to let you fool around with really valuable stuff, right? You're going to play it with clay or sand or paste. Kid, let's say. Or even if I were to start to sculpt, I'm not a sculptor, assumedly I wouldn't start with something really valuable. I'd start with clay. I'd start with paste. Till I'm qualified to work with something really valuable, like pearls, putting pearls into jewelry form. Then I drop the paste, hey, I've graduated, and deem myself a fool, and deem ourself a fool is a kind of a mannered way to say it. It seems mannered to us, seems dated to us. And deem ourself a fool. Look back on ourself and say, boy, you remember how we used to screw around with that paste and we used to mix it up, we didn't weren't any good at it? Boy, now, hey, now it's a different case. Now we are experienced artists. We know what we're about. The shapes, though, were similar. In other words, the things we worked at with paste we're still working at much more expertly, of course, with pearl, because now we're an accomplished artist. It's 20 years later. Our new hands, that is to say, our hands now developed, now experienced, practiced, skillful artistic hands, learned gem tactics, practicing with the paste, practicing with sand. So it's a wonderful little poem on the creative process, it seems to me. And the basic, so what's the basic message?
myself a fool is really tricky to me. I see three different ways it could go, and it really changes the message.
Go ahead.
One is, as you say, then I think there's one that's sort of an extension of that, which is, and we look back and see we were really stupid to have gone on playing with the paste all that time, because we could have, we really were ready to work with it. Then the other is, we qualify for the pearl, we start working with the pearl, but then we make mistakes. And then we just sort of have to pull ourselves together and say, well, the shapes were similar, and we really learned how to do this.
Uh-huh.
Well, I think my feeling about it was it just happened there in the craft room. There was a certain kind of slip knot that you tied to start the ink over. And we practiced and we practiced and we get it right, but we still didn't know how we did it, and we'd go over and do it. So when we finally did it, so we could do it several times, we thought, what fools, it took so long to learn.
It was very stupid. Stupid? How can I be so stupid? It's nothing to it. All you go is zit, zit, zit.
Yeah.
But it took me 5 years to learn how to do zit, zit, zit. What a fool I was. I don't know why I had so much trouble with that. Now, but the other interpretations are yours if you find them there. Remember, we talked yesterday about Robert Frost saying, and somebody said to him, did you mean this metaphor, Mr. Frost? And he said, no, I didn't have it in mind, but if you find it there, it's yours. It's perfectly valid, so it may very well be there.
I think if you just solve the slip knot problem, then you see it one way. You're still having trouble.
That's it.
Maybe you say it, maybe you say no. Look at what she does with meter here, by the way. Notice how simple the first stanza is. It's almost sing-song. We play at pace till qualified for pearl, then drop the pace and deem ourselves a fool. Then, however, when we move to the second stanza, it gets much more complex. The shapes, though, were similar. And our new hands learn gem tactics, practicing sands. So we've got a regular meter, first stanza, and irregular stanza, second meter. And irregular meter in the second stanza. And note, in the last two lines, we actually revert, we inverse. She reverses the meter, so we have short, long, long, short, learn gem tactics, and then we reverse it in the last line, practicing sands. So she's, the metric patterns she uses enforce the thought by reversing the beat. It's a much more complicated process in the second one. And look what she does with rhyme, too. She uses three kinds of rhyme. One is identical, paste. And she doesn't do this by accident, I assure you. She doesn't repeat a word without a very good reason. We play a paste till qualified for pearl, then drop the paste. Repetitious, you would say. No, that's all they're capable of handling. You see, very limited. Like the poet is very limited if he's got to use the same word. Then she has exact rhyme, hands and sands, and she also has then suspended or slant rhyme, what we call slant rhyme, where the word doesn't exactly rhyme, it just suggests the same sound in pearl and fool. See? So the intricacy of the rhyme scheme and the intricacy of the metric pattern and meter is complex, and it's complex under tight control. So there's a lot more happening than we might think. I love this poem. It's one of those poems you can think about a lot. Now, let us talk about our attitude toward God. How many of you were present at Vespers the other night when I talked about some of the poets? some weren't, right? Well, what I read there was some of her more innocent poems, one of her more poems that were appropriate for that service, but the fact is that Emily Dickinson was perplexed about God all her life, and she didn't know how she felt about God. She wasn't blessed with faith. She looked on faith as kind of blessing she didn't have, especially as a young woman. I envy those of my classmates who have found Christ, and I haven't found Christ. And she never found Christ in the terms that we use it. She believed, I'd say she was a Christian. I'd say she believed in Christ, but she never found the way to worship him. She never quite found a way to pray. She was, as was suggested, a kind of a pantheist, a kind of transcendentalist. Maybe you'd say that there were some of those two beliefs in her, as well as the Christian belief. One reason why our poems on God and immortality, which we'll deal with the day after tomorrow, are among her most fascinating. I quoted at one of our sessions, I guess it was the first forum, I think many of you were not present, I quoted one brief little poem that gives one of her attitudes about God. Faith is a fine invention for gentlemen who see, but microscopes are prudent in an emergency. Okay. So there you've got the whole science versus religion question. You have faith, but then there are some questions that maybe faith doesn't answer for you. So you have to use a microscope. You have to go to science. You have to go to the evidence. And that was a nice little succinct comment on her religious attitude. Let's take a look at page 10 of our handout. We've got one of her poems speaking on page 10. That top poem, pretty straightforward. Somebody want to try that one for me?
I know that he exists somewhere. Inside. He has hid his rare life from our gross eyes. 'Tis an instant's play, 'tis a fond ambush, just to make bliss, earn her own supply. Should not stop. Just to make bliss, earn her own surprise. But should the play prove piercing earnest, should the glee glaze in death's stiff stare, would not the fun look too expensive? Would not the jest have crawled too far?
Wow. Strong poem.
Yeah.
Provocative poem. What's the moral, would you say, in the measure that there is a moral?
That's what you said. She really has.
She hadn't found
it. It's between real and unreal.
Right. Right. In her last, as I mentioned at Vespers, in her last note to her dearest cousins, she sent a four-word message just before she died. And that is on her gravestone now. Little cousins called back. And I've been speculating recently about the degree to which that was on her part at least a smidge of play. And the kind of play she's talking about in these first two verses here, because the little cousins were no longer little cousins. I mean, she was 55. They were a little bit younger, so they were maybe 50. So they weren't little cousins, they were grown-up, middle-aged ladies. So little cousins is acute, nice, it's nice. way to refer to them, just the way we often use the childhood names for relatives and close friends, like Jimmy. An intimate form of a word, a nickname that the kid had in the schoolyard. If you keep your friendship, you still use that nickname, even though you're now both 60 years old. Nobody else uses it, but you use it. It's kind of fun. So little cousins, she used to write to them as little cousins when they were indeed little cousins, right? She was 10 and they were 5. She wrote little cousins. When she was 20 and they were 15, little cousins. Now she's 55 and they're 50. She's still writing little cousins. Very nice. But there's an element of play in that. When you do that, when you call your old friend whom everybody else calls James, you still always refer to him as Jimmy. Everybody else calls him Jim. You always call him Jimmy. Little cousins is kind of kidding. So then, call back. Call back is a very standard term for Christians to talk about dying. I'm called back to God, whom I was before. Now I'm called back to Him. That's very 19th century. That's the way they would have referred to it. But since she's kidding the first two words, and since she never gave indication that she was indeed found, that she was reborn, as folks might say these days, that she found Christ. There's no indication at the very end she found Christ. And so maybe up to the very end she was going through the same word play, the same play, called back. I don't know. Nobody will ever know, I guess, but it's an interesting
thing. On the other hand, it might mean what this meant.
Exactly. It might have meant, I now accept, I think probably a lot of doubters, people who believe and not quite believe, at the very end they say, I do believe now.
Maybe she had written little cousins some of her doubts, and this was addressed to them that she had
written to them some doubts. They knew she was a doubter. Yes, she was quite frank with them, and she sent them some poems like this. Mm-hmm. Indeed, when I ask the moral, you might say that the moral is, you better pay attention to a religion, because let's say we're in a Christian society, let's say it's Christianity, because if you prove wrong, if you are an averred, stated agnostic, a doubter, or worse, a pagan, and then turns out your mother was right all the time, and you missed the boat. Oh, missed the boat. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a little worse than that, right?
It's a little worse than that. So this is one of the poems that really infuriated people. Indeed, it may upset some of you. I mean, it's playing a game with God. It's saying, you playing with us, Lord, but, and it's okay, I'm willing to play. Is it true or isn't it true? But why? What if it proves earnest? And what if it's really for real? And you haven't revealed yourself. She's got some other poems where she talks about his not having revealed himself. I think that might be a little unfair of you. Is that a fair rule then, Lord, for you to have played with us? So this is the questing, constantly looking, doubting, using the tool of doubt constantly to probe. And she did reject, as I mentioned the other night, she did reject the worship of the Old Testament harsh God, the gloom and doom of the Puritan heritage which she grew up with in New England. It was harsh. She found it was harsh. She felt that it was kind of husk of what she understood it had been in the time of Jonathan Edwards. By that time in New England, there's a lot of evidence that it was a kind of shallow, the way those Puritans and the descendants of the Puritans in a place like Amherst, in a small town in New England. Let's take a look at another poem. By the way, do any of you have this book? Okay, Betty's got one. Betty's got one. I don't think there's going to be enough for us to go around, though. So I mentioned before that I like to mix up the studying of poem that's before you and the analyzing the poem as I did the very first one, which you don't have in front of you, because poetry is meant to be read aloud and to be effort to understand it based on the sound of the words is important too. So I won't try to arrange for all of us to look on two books, but let me read a couple of poems that are pretty tough in terms of their doubt which they express. Heavenly Father, take to thee the supreme iniquity fashioned by thy candid hand in a moment contraband. Though to trust us seem to us more respectful, we are dust. We apologize to thee for thine own duplicity. Now that last two lines is what has made a lot of Christians mad. One minister in the 1890s, when this poem came out, said, "That's the worst example of Unitarianism I've ever heard in my life." Sure. I'll read the whole thing again. Heavenly Father, take to thee the supreme iniquity fashioned by thy candid hand in a moment contraband. Though to trust us seem to us more respectful, we are dust. We apologize to thee for thine own duplicity. You haven't leveled with us. You have deceived us, Lord. You haven't even told us what the sins are, as clearly enough for my liking, she's saying. We apologize to thee for thine own duplicity. Let me share another one with you, which has some of the same. This is one of those where she uses different metaphors for the deity. She uses all kinds of different ones. I mentioned the other night at Vespers where she talks to God as though he's a friend, and the one where she describes the sun. Cloud comes out and puts himself, the star comes out and puts himself in place, then the moon takes off her bonnet and everything else gets set, and then the light becomes just right and it's all very much in order. And the final line is, "Father, I said to heaven, you are punctual." You are punctual. So that's the kind of thing that you'd say to a friend. "Well, you're really punctual." God is a lot more than punctual, isn't he? God's a lot more than punctual, but she talks to him.
Can you take me 1 second?
Yeah. Okay, here's another one. Now, here we use the metaphor of the shopkeeper for God. God is a shopkeeper, and the shopkeeper often says, before you pay, the cash register says, "Is there nothing else? Is there nothing else that we can sell you?" So she is in the shop, presumably, and God is a shopkeeper. Is that a shopkeeper? "I ask no other thing No other was denied. I offered being for it. The mighty merchant sneered. Brazil? He twirled a button without a glance my way. But madam, is there nothing else that we can show today? Let me try it one more time. I asked no other thing. No other was denied. I offered being for it. The mighty merchant sneered. Brazil? He twirled a button without a glance my way. But madam, is there nothing else that we can show today? She's offering being for it.
For nothing.
For what? What do you think it is?
To be able to write the poems.
Maybe. Be able to write the poems might be one. What else do you think it might be? It's in context of what I've been discussing previously. You're kind of jumping back anyway, which is fair, but
eternal life. Eternal life.
Could be eternal life. How about it vis-a-vis the game poem? Playing this game with us. And should it prove in earnest, and when I die I find that it's for real, isn't that going a little far? Is that fair? What about that, this poem in the context of that? Then what might it be, if we put those in context, in the same context, what it might be that she wants to buy in the shop of the mighty merchant who's clearly God?
Himself?
Sure. The secret of immortality, you might say. I went into the shop looking for one thing, and I bought some other things too in there, right? I bought good health for my family, and I bought some other things, and those weren't denied. Those weren't denied. I got those, right? Nice home, food on the table, got these things. The Lord was very good, gave me these things. I'm blessed. Then I asked for this one thing. I offered being for it. He went about to give it to me. Which was the secret, I think, is my interpretation. The secret of immortality. Is it real or isn't it real? But I'm particularly intrigued by this poem because of the way she refers to God as a mighty merchant. That's something that made people mad too.
Can you read it again?
Sure. I asked no other thing. No other was denied. I offered being for it. The mighty merchant sneered. Brazil? He twirled a button without a glance my way. But madam, is there nothing else that we can show today? Why Brazil? Why Brazil?
Well, I think her world was so narrow, confined to her home, as she was. Brazil is the world.
Brazil is a world. It's huge. It's enormous. It's a long way away.
It would be entirely different from what she was used to.
Yeah. Exactly. Mysterious, unknown, unexplored by anybody she knew.
Yeah.
And therefore, she picks it. It has all those characteristics for her. And it's somehow it's just kind of right. Brazil, not one of the smaller Latin American countries, the biggest one, the most mysterious one, with that huge river that.
And you think of Brazil as being, lots of music.
Yeah.
Not at all like Anderson.
Oh, no.
Yeah, not at all like
that. Complete that.
That was a diversion by the mighty merchant offering all this, but to show.
Yeah, yeah. You're asking for Brazil? In this shop, you're asking. Isn't there anything else? Can I sell you some licorice?
I thought he was offering Brazil.
No, he's saying, you know, he's got a question mark. The mighty merchant sneered. Brazil? So she said, could you sell me Brazil, sir?
No.
And what would a shopkeeper now say? Isn't there anything else that I've got here in the store? I'm not even going to say I don't have Brazil. It's obvious I don't have Brazil. I'm not even going to talk to you about it. I'm not even going to talk to you about your request for Brazil.
I thought this was, he was using that as a diversion.
No, it's pretty clearly, it's Brazil question mark, you see. I asked no other thing, no other was denied, I offered being for it. Mm-hmm. And now is the response, the mighty merchant sneered. Then the one word he says before he says, it's not in quotes, but before he says, but madam, is there nothing else that we can show today? Brazil, question mark. It might even say, Brazil? I mean, if you went over in the bookstore here, and you went out to one of our colleagues in there, and you said, I'm interested in buying Brazil.
Well, Christina would answer.
Christina would say, well, listen, we've got some roomy books here. We've got a lot of nice t-shirts. So maybe we should ask for Brazil. Okay, I think it's time to stop. I've got some others on God that I wanted to share, and maybe I'll get to those when I talk about immortality. God, what he stands for, and death, which she was very much absorbed with, and immortality are often kind of mixed in her poems, but certain ones are quite clear about God, especially when he uses a metaphor for God, like the mighty merchant. But she does try to keep them separate, but I think it would be okay if I maybe squeeze in one or two of the other poems that I wanted to talk about God. Tomorrow we'll talk about love, what love meant to her. And then the final day we'll talk about immortality.
What time is your session tomorrow?
6:30.
On the evening?
She gets to you. She gets to you.
Are these scattered throughout her work? Or?
Yes, they are scattered throughout her work. There are collections of her poetry which treat subject by subject. This is not true of Final Harvest, however. That is largely chronological. At the time that she wrote the poem.
Because these are chronological.
Those are roughly chronological, right, in the measure that they can be categorized chronologically.
We'll see two right in front of it look like. Is that right? Two different times? The journey is advanced.
She would get on a theme and write a number of poems
about it.
Well,
that's what I wondered if they...
Yeah, they tend to, in a way, but they'll jump back and forth, subject by subject. I mentioned, by the way, just to, since somebody seems to be getting up and rushing out here, look on page 10, the one under the I Know That Exists poem, which I mentioned the other day. She liked to look straight in the face at things, uniquely so. She recognized, by the way, in a poem that I want to share with you, probably the last day, where she said, well, let me say it for you because it's we're looking at a poem, the first two lines of which are, I like the look of agony because I know it's true. This is a pretty shocking thing. Say, right? You can't simulate a throw, she says. You can't simulate a convulsion. But she wrote another poem, in effect, saying that nobody else can take it head on the way I can. Nobody else likes the look of agony. Everybody who likes the look of agony raises his hand. We'll get one person to raise his hand. She wanted the truth. She went for the truth. But she also knew that most people can't. So she wrote a poem to this effect. Tell all the truth, but tell it slant. Success in circuit lies. Too bright for our infirm delight. The truth's superb surprise. As lightning to the children eased by explanations kind, the truth must dazzle gradually, or every man be blind. So she recognized that you never could say, you sinned, God hates you. Yeah, right. But most people, even the toughest preachers will usually say, God looks on you with disfavor. God. And they don't hit it quite that dread on. Cotton Mather used to. He'll burn in hell. But in this one, she talks about looking straight at things. And we'll close with this. We're at the bottom of page 10, number 241. I like a look of agony because I know it's true. Man, do not shame convulsion, nor simulate a throw. The eyes glaze once, and that is death. Impossible to feign. The beads upon the forehead by homely anguish strung. About as uncompromising a poem as you're going to find.